This is Monocle on Design, a show where we unpack everything from architecture and craft to furniture and fashion. I'm Nick Manise. On today's program, we visit one of architect Daniel Lieberskind's newest projects and talk about some of the top 100 practicing women architects. All that coming up on Monocle on Design. Good architecture and healthcare rarely go hand in hand, especially in countries like the UK, where financial strains have led to a drop in quality of medical facilities. Providing cancer care of the highest standard in uplifting, design-led architectural environments are Maggie's centres. They have, for the last 29 years, been breaking the mould. The newest centre to open is designed by Daniel Lieberskind, the architect behind the Jewish Museum Berlin and New York's One World Trade Centre master plan. Located at the centre of the Royal Free Hospital in North London and occupying a small plot, the building expands outwards as it rises, and the effect inside and out, well, it's striking and beautiful. Monocle's David Pleasant went to see the new Maggie's with Daniel Lieberskind himself.
Cutting-edge architecture from a show-stopping roster of international architects is not something that is traditionally associated with healthcare, and particularly with the treatment of cancer. At least that used to be the case before the creation of Maggie's Centres in Britain. Founded in 1995 and taking its name from Maggie Keswick Jenks, the late wife of American landscape designer and postmodern architect and theorist Charles Jenks, the network now boasts 26 centres in the UK, as well as Maggie's in Barcelona, Hong Kong and Tokyo. Central to the mission is to create architect-led places that foster a more holistic and positive approach to cancer care. With architects such as Frank Gehry, Zaha Hadid and Richard Rogers, to name but a few, having put their names to the centres, Maggie's, rather like the Serpentine Gallery's summer pavilion construction in London, has become a byword for architectural prestige. Having had to wait many years to design a Maggie's Centre of his own, Daniel Lieberskind was in London to open the striking building at Hampstead's Royal Free Hospital. He began by telling me about his friendship with Charles and Maggie Jenks and how the story began.
Charles was a very close friend of mine. And the first site that I was given in London had difficulties, didn't go forward. Then another site was given to me in Cambridge some years later, which also had complications. And then this site came up, and Maggie said to me, you know, this is, you know, in a parking lot, but we can get a site on the street, on a corner. Very. I said, no, I'll take this site.
What, right? you wanted to take it?
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
I didn't want to wait anymore
It was a long wait. And how lucky, because it turned out to be a fantastic site.
It is quite a difficult site. I'm going to try and explain for radio listeners. We're kind of enclosed in the big brutalist concrete building that is the hospital behind us, and then there's various walls and residential buildings. So it's not a typical plot.
No, it's not. And I think that was the challenge. How do you transform this site and make it beautiful for people who will use this Maggie Center? And how do you give them a completely new orientation, not dominated by the big, you know, hospital and by everything around it, but create a world of its own, which is a world of intimacy, a world of poetry, a world of meditation, a place to be happy in.
Your approach, you've talked a lot about memory in architecture, but maybe is there something else going on in this? Is it more about empathy, or what's the kind of guiding thing you're looking to achieve within this particular building? There's a musicality to it? There's something. I mean,
you're correct. There's a musical structure. It's like a sonata form. You have the four seats of curvature, which are then contrasted with the planar elements, four planar elements, and it's a journey through the building. It's a whole. Wherever you are, you can be in the yoga room, you can be in the kitchen, you can be in a library, whatever, but you're connected to a sort of sense of new scale, domestic scales, a scale that is for you. It's not just some abstraction.
I'm Michael Ashley.
Okay, and your role at...
I'm a principal at Studio Leibskind.
And one of the lead designers.
Yeah, we were leading the design team.
The entrances come in through those glazing portions, and the walls then are expressed coming all the way inside to the outside to really kind of give that exterior-interior feeling.
Yes.
And then the fenestration all around is kind of a play on the surfaces. So all of these, the geometry of the surfaces are what we call ruled surfaces. So it's a non-rational curvature. But from the top to the bottom, it's all done with straight linear lines. And then the windows are kind of formed out of that and then composed to create the play of light as it comes in. But there's these little seating nooks throughout and little pockets that you'll see as we walk through. And the entire space, if you stand here, you can look down, you can look out. It's really just flowing from one to the next. It's not composed of a series of compartmentalized rooms. The idea was really openness and lightness and air.
Is there a kind of set brief with Maggie's centers in general? So is there kind of like, yeah, there's a worksheet?
There is, but it's also open for interpretation, I would say. Mm-hmm. So they like to have places where people can congregate. They like the openness. The kitchen and the table is always the center, a big attraction for people coming in. But then there needs to be some private rooms.
Yeah.
This is one of the counseling rooms. And this is one of the few rooms where you can actually close the door. All of the other seating areas, we have some curtains for privacy. We just have like little nooks near the glazing where you can sit and have a view out and have a conversation. But if you really need to have like a personal, more private conversation, this one only has a few places to do that. And this is one of those rooms where we can close the door.
Is there some ways that you've attempted to, maybe the thickness of the walls, like there's a kind of feeling a little bit of privacy is created, so it's not completely, you know, the windows aren't flush with the walls, so you're not kind of floor-to-ceiling windows for everyone to peer in, especially if there's a large building opposite.
And so when you look at a certain vista, like an angle like we see here, you don't really see out. You see the light bouncing in, but the view is obscured because of the thickness of the walls.
Yeah.
But there's more reason for the thickness.
Okay.
Part of it is also the fabrication of the walls. Part of it is the performance of the envelope, so it's very high performing, lots of insulation. It's a passive building, so we're trying to minimize energy use and be more sustainable in that way.
But that kind of thickness is quite a Studio Leibskind.
It comes along with the geometry.
Motif. Yes. Yeah, okay.
There's a lot of structure that has to hold up these cantilevers.
It's using architecture fully. It's not being limited by some banal, you know, typologies that come from some industrial norm of building cheap walls at right angles to the ground. It's using the building as an organic element to infuse it with light, to infuse it with interest, with a kind of coherence of variety of windows and views that are, you know, constructed for each space. So yeah, it's not a cookie cutter building. It's not taken from somewhere else. It's unique, as the people who will be using it are unique.
Were you kind of thinking of that eventual user, or the person who's going to come and use it? Did you have them in mind kind of throughout the whole process? Were you kind of putting yourself in their shoes or your design team?
No.
No?
No, I don't think I design a building as a transaction with a user.
Right.
Because that would be too limited. You have to design a beautiful place that will speak to each person in their own way. It's not some calculation about emotions to be aroused. It's creating a building that really functions well in terms of its stability, reorientation, light, materiality, warmth, scale. That's really the classical way a building should be designed.
And again, it's about not being the cookie cutter, not having a formula, as it were.
Well, it's not only negative. Of course, too many buildings are just repetitions and formulas. But if you're designing a unique building for a unique use, and that's Maggie's, you work very closely with your client. They know exactly what they want, where they want it to be. and you construct a space that is fully functional, but really a poetic space, a space which is not just a machine to process people, but a place to be, to meet others, and to have a sense of solidarity, with others in this building.
What do you think Maggie, the original Maggie, would have thought of this space if she were sitting here with us?
I really don't know, but I think Maggie was a brilliant person, and so was Charles. And I think their idea of raising the bar, that these facilities of health should not be just footnotes to other, that they should really be a humanistic sense of communicating through architecture the various functions that will take place in this building. The entire mission of Maggie's is so brilliant. If you look at all the other Maggie centers, which I've been to many, how wonderful they are. And it's really an example of what an idea can do to transform people's attitude to health. It's brilliant.
For Monocle in Hampstead, North London, I'm David Pleasant.
The same stories, the same views dominate global news coverage. But The Globalist goes beyond the noise to unpack what's really happening, to find fresh perspectives and considered voices in current affairs, business, and much more.
She was doing this all on her own, and I think that she's been a real inspiration to journalists around the world, particularly where there are tough areas of freedom of speech.
I think that one of the mantras that's going to come out of Washington in the Biden administration going forward is unity, but unity with accountability.
The Globalist, live every weekday at 8 a.m. Zurich time, 7 a.m. in London, or wherever you get your podcasts.
"100 Women, Architects in Practice" is a new title published by the Royal Institute of British Architects, or REBA. Its aim, to provide a reference point for the profession and a resource highlighting top designers across the globe, who just happen to be women. The publication features illustrated interviews unpacking how these creatives are looking to connect architecture, people and landscape. Two of the book's co-authors, Tom Ravenscroft and Monica Parinder, join me in the studio. Tom began by sharing why it was important to pull together a book that was about architects and women practicing in the field now, rather than looking at the past.
When I initially started the project with Harriet, we were going to focus on living and dead architects, I suppose. And when we pitched it and when it was originally commissioned, it was for both living and dead architects. And then through the kind of discussions of how we take it forward, and then also spending time looking at other books that have been written on women in architecture, we realised that would be much more beneficial projects, a much more kind of like interesting project to focus entirely on women architects who are currently alive, rather than the tick box of kind of Zahra Hadid, Lina Bobardi. In the last kind of, let's say, decade, there's been a growing awareness of that group and more attention paid to them. And we wanted this project really to kind of spread out that focus on broadening the number of well-known or even vaguely known women architects.
Monica, from your perspective, the way I sort of see this book is it is an incredible resource that, you know, you can almost flip open and jump to anywhere in the world and you'll be able to find an amazing practicing architect. What do you hope that by focusing, I guess, on people that are alive, what do you hope this book will become or help people achieve? Is there an ambition that goes beyond just a book that presents a host of amazing portfolios?
I mean, I think so. I mean, at heart, everybody's needs a stake in the future of the built environment. And we want a much broader set of voices talking about what that's going to look like. So we're going to architects, but our panels, you know, in design festivals are often full of men. Universities, the reading lists are full of men, or the practice models are. So the models are very narrow. The perspectives are not very wide. And really, we just need to diversify the set of voices that are contributing to how we're going to build our future.
This sort of presents a model or almost like a first step for a lot of people. I think what's fascinating to me about the book as well is the fact that you've broken the book up into UN geographies.
Yes, exactly what you said. We're talking about diversity of voices, and that's, I mean, the book has women written on the front cover, but it's not just diversity like men, women. Also, it's geographical diversity, and there's whole swathes of the world that aren't really talked about broadly in architectural discussions. And so we were super keen that this book would be a geographically diverse. And that was our initial idea. And then trying to make that reality was harder, because dividing up the world equally is a very hard task. And we kind of looked at whether it's large amounts of populations or by countries. I mean, potentially there'd be another fun project, which would be 200 women architects with one woman from every country. But anyway, trying to divide up in multiple ways, by population was an issue, because pretty much half the world lives in Asia. And so we eventually found that UN divides up the world into continents and subregions, and they are Europe, Africa, Asia, the Americas, which they treat as one, and Oceania. That worked really well for us because it puts an emphasis on Africa and Asia. Each of those have 25 subregions. So Africa, for example, North Africa, South Africa, East, West, Central. And then that meant that we had 5 from each of those subregions.
By virtue of doing that, you're placing equal emphasis on, you know, maybe architects in Central Asia as you are in the Americas. Like, I think that's what I find quite fascinating about this. And it really is, I guess, for readers or architecture enthusiasts, broadening out that discussion and I guess getting more names involved in a global discussion. Is that part of the aim?
Yeah, I mean, basically it created a framework for us that we had to work within. And within that framework, there are only 5 women architects from North America in the book, whereas North America would usually be a place which is very, very heavily talked about, only 20 in Europe. And it just meant that when we wanted to find the people to include in the book, we had to stick to this relatively rigid framework. It meant that we had to find 5 women from Central Asia, like you said, which meant spending time trying to find people in countries like Uzbekistan or Tajikistan that aren't hugely well known for their architecture, let alone architecture designed by women. So yeah, it basically forced us to be as diverse as possible. I'm sure we could have done more. I'm sure there's flaws in what we did, but it at least made it as geographically diverse as we could be.
And I guess it's also a starting point for broader conversations around design. I mean, Monica, I want to ask you, and this is specific to a comment from Alison Brooks, who's a fabulous Canadian architect who wrote the foreword, but she talked about, you know, the fact that this book is, and I'm quoting here, this is my wonderful wording, but it's about seeking the expressive potential of architectures founded in local geographies, social structures and ecologies. I mean, so this is about more than, I guess, just unearthing great architects. It's also about examining the way that architecture is practiced across the globe. I mean, what are some of those local geographies or social structures or ecologies that you have seen reflected in this work in terms of maybe there's a new architectural style or one we haven't heard of?
Well, I think at heart this is about when you get more diverse practices, you're moving outside of the colonial model or the modernist model or development model of one size fits all. And you're saying that every place around the globe has its own external factors and internal factors, and you're saying that therefore you need different solutions. So what's key about all these women is that, and I'm going to talk about women because the book is about women, but I'm not discounting men working in, you know, regions, say the Global South, etc. But they're really interested in asking questions about context. So about histories of where they are, about place, about materials, indigenous knowledge. Really, they're trying to heal the kind of disconnected relationship between architecture, people and land by bringing people and landscape back into the building. And, you know, so it looks different everywhere. But actually, the methods and the thinking is quite coherent. It's just not one size fits all.
Can we unpack some of that method and that thinking? I mean, I guess in my mind, we've got architects listening across the globe that might be wanting to take some of these lessons away from them. But what's the mindset shift that you sort of started to unpack, or a trend that you observed?
Across 100 interviews, patterns kept popping out. So we did do the work in the intro where we tried to look at common repetitions in the words and practices. And we did try to identify about 6 loose common agendas. But the interesting thing is it didn't become a manifesto because, of course, each of these, and I'll tell you for an example with one, plurality is at the heart of it. So participation, but enjoying the unpredictability of that. So if you participate and bring in the voices and stakes of the local community, the idea that the aesthetics or the preconceived ideas about what might be built have to let go. So you have to enjoy the process that you lose control of the aesthetics. So that would be one example that there's a complete shift, the ego and the control of the architect, that we know what's best. We're listening to others, but we actually allow them into the process, so it's organic.
I mean, you mentioned the word healing there. How does this help, I guess, people? You know, and are we talking about healing relationships between an architecture that's imposed on people and a community? Or, like, how does this outlook or this approach help in a healing process?
So another theme that we kind of picked out was care and connection. So the argument there is that around the world, colonial agendas and development agendas have often been kind of implemented through architecture, so it's disconnected people from their communities and lands. So a lot of the women, they just see the practice of architecture as reconnecting people through the process of building and reconnecting the landscape and architecture. So it's really quite exciting for architecture because it's making it more reciprocal with people and land, which is what we need for future.
What I'm kind of hearing from this is it is just almost like a framework for good practice. Like, it's about almost putting people at the centre of a building. Like, in my mind, architecture really is something that should be about that end user and really reflecting their needs and their desires. And maybe egos have got in the way in the past. Like you said, maybe there are some other, you know, political or government or colonial agendas that are stopping that happening. But this is really about, I guess, reconsidering our relationship with those end users. I've just put words in your mouth, but is that another way of looking at it?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And that it's not just that it's about the ego, but that it might not even be a built structure that is the outcome if something more temporary is needed. So it's about how people use space. And is the answer a new building? That's the question mark. So you listen to what people need.
Tom, I want to bring you in here because this is also about reconsidering the architectural canon. And I think particularly in the 20th century, you know, everything around the world was so dominated by this international style. That's not to say that that's, you know, still not something relevant and we can celebrate. But I guess it's also about looking beyond that. I mean, what did you pick up that might or should be worthy of consideration and inclusion in that canon?
Well, like Monica said, a lot of it is seeing the connections between people working in vastly different conditions in different regions or different places on different projects, broadly approaching it in a way that has huge similarities. I mean, potentially that's a little bit of like author bias. I mean, potentially we picked people who were doing what we consider to be interesting work, and often that was not necessarily kind of bombastic architecture. So like we've kind of we've probably influenced what we found through our choices of who we decided to kind of feature in the book. That said, there were just huge connections in approach and people, I think, wanting to approach architecture in a different way to the generation that went before them. And that was partly through the process, the collaboration, the kind of participation, like Monica said, but also through the education where they work. We found a lot of people, a lot of women in the book had been educated often outside their countries, have left the country for education. And I think in previous generations may have stayed in their kind of place of education, whether that be the US, France, the UK, but have deliberately kind of and actively come back to their kind of countries to, I mean, help seems like doesn't quite feel like the right word, but to kind of participate maybe in creating architecture for good in the places that they have initially come from. And that was a topic that kind of happened quite a bit.
How do you start to define that? Is that something that these people you spoke to, I mean, this goes out to both of you, is that something that came out in what you talked to these people about? Were they talking about wanting to leave a legacy that was about more than their own portfolio?
A lot of the women talked about that. I mean, again, we got to kind of like slightly think of that in the context that almost everyone who's working as an architect probably thinks they're contributing something good, whether that be designing a school that's kind of perfectly aligned to its users, or whether that's designing a skyscraper that they think is more environmentally friendly than the next one, you know? So probably I the benefit of the doubt for a majority of architects, I think they're probably all trying to do something positive. But here it definitely felt like they were trying to do maybe more community-led positive projects, things that actually had a benefit to the community they came from. It's hard to talk in absolutes because the boomin just were so diverse, and that's what was the biggest joy of the project, I think, is kind of privilege of being able to interview and speak to them, 100 different women, huge different sexes from everywhere in the world.
It's the contingency of the word good that has been recognised, and that's the difference. So one person's good is another person's homelessness, etc., etc. So what I found was that the women were trying to work in an interconnected way. So they wouldn't solve one problem but create three knock-on problems. And in a way, that's what I'd quite call a good practice, because you're thinking about ongoing impacts. So an example would be they were always trying to solve social and sustainable problems together. And they were always trying to reconnect architecture with land and people together, mindful that my good is, you know, your displacement. And actually just try and mitigate that so that the future doesn't create that kind of mindset.
What we just talked about there, they were also, with the book, we wanted to present a certain view of architecture, and we've kind of chosen people who align with that viewpoint as well. It was important for the book to not just present women, but to present women we thought were doing interesting, whether it be worthy or work. So definitely our findings are biased by our choosings.
I think as well, what jumped out at me there was, it almost sounds like the way that, like, sustainability can mean so many different things to so many different people. And if you're doing sustainability right, it's not just making sure it's economically sustainable, but making sure it's, you know, culturally, or that it feeds back to the community, that it does serve the environment. Is that almost what this is about in a way? Like, there's a good is making sure that it ticks all those boxes and serves that triple bottom line, is the cliche we use, but yeah, going beyond that.
I mean, I'd say something that's good is reciprocal. And if we have a reciprocal relationship to the land and to people, then it can carry on. And actually, that's what sustainability is, really. It's how long can this carry on? And things that are reciprocal carry on way longer.
I don't know if there's anything also to be said about the way that, I guess, the women in this book also practice architecture. There seem to be some that are like Liz Diller, that are really just your standard, what I think of that sort of standard beautiful, amazing practitioner, makes sensational work. But then you've also got someone like Tosi Oshinowo, who is, you know, also curating whilst also practicing at the same time. How has the role of the architect changed, and how is that reflected in this book?
One of the things of the book is that while trend right now is architecture, not architects. One of the things we wanted in the book was for all the women to be architects, kind of with a capital A, and trained architects rather than academics or architectural practitioners, partly because it's super hard qualification to get, and we wanted to, again, limit ourselves and not cheat and not be able to find an architect in Congo, so use an academic instead. But that said, the women we've interviewed are often, they've been practicing architecture in a less traditional way, whether that be curating away or whether that is collaboration, working with communities. Yeah, we've deliberately tried to find a broad perspective, I think. We wanted women in the book who are running traditional, let's say, architecture studios and are competing kind of at the top level and like are rivaling the best male architects in the world at their game, let's say. But also we wanted to have a whole vast perspective of architects doing stuff in a different way. I mean, part of this book is showing lots of different faces doing architecture, and people that look like other people doing architecture, but also people doing architecture in a way that is kind of aspirational, whether that be giant cultural centres and museums, or whether that be improving homelessness in Thailand.
The key thing is it's not about adding more names to the canon or what we just call the status quo. It's about seeing different perspectives, different worldviews, but the trick is to see how they coexist. And it's in seeing how they coexist that you get new innovations, possibly systemic change, and all the new possibilities that we need for moving on. And that's the revolutionary part.
Monica Parinder and Tom Ravenscroft there. 100 Women, Architects in Practice is published by Riva and available at all good bookstores now. And that's all for today's show. For more design stories, listen to our 5-minute midweek bonus show, Monocle on Design Extra, which airs on Thursdays. And if you enjoy print, then do pick up a copy of Monocle magazine as well. It's on all good newsstands now. Today's episode was produced and edited by Maylee Evans. I'm Nick Manise, and you can reach me on nm@monocle.com. Thanks for listening.